well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The Second Amendment.
Today's guest with Lee and myself is Ashley Lubinsky, and we appreciate very much for her calling in. Ashley, from a personal perspective, what does the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution mean to you?
Oh, gosh. You know, no one has ever asked me that question.
Really?
What does the Second Amendment mean to me? I love that you asked that and you stumped me on it at 7:30 on a Friday night.
It's okay. You know, and seriously, if you need time to think, we can come back to it, right, Joe?
I mean, absolutely. Yeah. You don't have to tell me right now. What's interesting, and one of the reasons I was really excited at the Goals event, this was the first time attending one. I didn't make last year's. But when you were on stage speaking at that main ballroom, one of the things that you had brought up that when people are discussing firearms in today's current era, one of the arguments a lot of anti-gun or pro-regulation people use is that when the Second Amendment was ratified, there wasn't the type of firearms there are now. And the pro-gun argument often comes back to that there was the puckle gun, which existed 70 years prior to that. And you said specifically, if I recall, that there's way better examples than the puckle gun.
Yeah. So, I think that was probably the nicest way I ever put it.
So I'd like you to expand on that, because that's one of the arguments that as an individual, I've used, that the puckle gun existed and that wasn't a musket-style firearm that took a minute to reload.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting, because when you live in the history sphere, right, like there's a million things going around in my brain constantly. Examples of firearms that existed and, different kind of scenarios in which they were used. But then it's so fascinating to me how certain things get pulled out and become talking points, right? Or become like the go-to example. And I get it. Like, I've talked about it for both sides, right? Like the pro-gun side and the pro-restriction side. Like, you have to make things digestible for people, right? Like, I can't just sit here and like talk at people constantly. Nothing would ever get done. You know, you have to synthesize it. But I always find it interesting what people like choose to like lock onto. Because usually, and I feel like it's probably like the same as like a gun person watching a movie, you know, with guns in it and it's not right. And you know all the nuance of it.
Oh yeah. Do you do that? Yeah. Do you sort of like,
no, I don't actually.
Okay.
I try to avoid, I don't really like action movies.
Yeah.
And it's
yeah.
terrible, but I don't like war movies either. It's like work. It's kind of like why when I travel, people are like, oh, make sure to check out this museum. And I'm like, no, I'm good. Like unless I'm getting paid to walk in there, I think I'm good today. but it's kind of like that for me, because, you know, I understand that things have to become digestible for people. But it's always interesting what gets chosen as like the things that we put up there on a pedestal. And what I was talking about at Goals was the Belton repeating rifle and the puckle gun. Because those are the examples that get repeated like time and time and time again. I think Dana Lash talked about them in her book, in one of her books. Like, I know I've heard a lot of people talk about them. And to me, like, yes, they are examples of repeating technology prior to the founding era, but they're kind of some of the worst examples in terms of holding up in a debate. And like, I don't want to get too down in the weeds on it, but I'll explain why I think they're kind of the worst, and I'll explain why they're difficult to hold up in court as examples. Like, if you're just trying to list examples of repeating technology, like, of course, those are on the list. But the puckle gun, we're really talking more of an artillery piece. So we're talking a gun. And a lot of times I do make the distinction for people that a firearm is a portable gun. Mm-hmm. A gun can be, artillery, yes, cannons, all that.
Sure.
So you are talking about, you know, a really big kind of non-movable or difficult to move thing, but it's also very, very slow. It was overseas, which isn't an issue, but it does come up in courts because there's the debate back and forth of like, well, if it was overseas, would they have known about it in the colonies? Mm-hmm. But it was just, it wasn't very successful. It's just a really weird, obscure, example. And my friend, who is the keeper of arms at the Royal Armouries in Leeds in the UK, he fondly refers to the inventor as a nutter. and we kind of all just kind of like, whatever, that gun. And then the Belton is a repeating rifle, a fusee, if you will. That's the French term for it. Yes. And what it was it was a superposed gun. And I can, you can, if you want me to get into more depth on what kind of repeaters there were, I can, but I'll just kind of move through that. But basically, it's this repeating gun that is developed in the colonies. So you've got prior to founding era. It is, oh gosh, I think like they were 7 shot, but with a normal superposed gun, you do have to do different motions in order to get it to fire more than once. There were lots of different types of superposed guns. They weren't all like that, but you know, you either had like multiple cocking mechanisms, or you had one cocking mechanism that operated on a slide, and you had to like prime the pan like every time. So there's lots of steps that go into it. But the Belton, developed in the 1750s, it did, and the reason why people talk about it is because Congress did order 100 of them to be made for the military, but for many reasons that ended up getting canceled. And so they weren't actually adopted. And the reason it becomes a sticky topic in the court system when you're going back and forth of technologies that existed is that the surviving Beltons of this type of Belton, because I'm about to explain why that I have a better version of that. The surviving of those Beltons, the provenance of the artifacts is questionable on one and notoriously faked on the others. And that is something that gets brought up in the courts, because these are, you know, we know that the gun was made, like we know the gun was designed, we know it existed, but when the surviving examples are questionable, you know, that becomes very difficult to try to have that conversation.
Sure.
Because then you could try to write that off. Now, what did happen, and what I think is a far better example, still uses Belton, but Joseph Belton went overseas into the UK in the 1780s, so several decades later, but still pre-founding era. And he partnered up with a gun maker named Jover in England. And they created a modified version of this called the Belton Jover. Mm. And what it ended up being was just like the original Belton on steroids. There were several different kinds. They were in pistol, rifle, carbine form. There you could fire it as a single shot. You could fire it as a repeater. And then some of them had port fire capability. So like basically like you were able to kind of through this gas system, like pull the trigger and let her rip. And it fired, according to my colleague in England who has them at the Royal Armouries, it fires at the same rate as a modern semi-automatic, is like wild to think of when you're thinking about the 1780s. And then if that wasn't good enough, you've got that kind of speed. They have detachable magazines.
Wow.
Because, you know, a lot of those superposed are muzzle loaders. So you have to load, you know, all those charges down the barrel. And so this actually had like a magazine, like a tube where you could carry a bunch of them like loaded, and then you could like swap them out and swap them back into the barrel. So that's crazy advanced. And then the one of the more important ones of who would have known about them, they were actually bought in mass by the East India Trading Company, like 600 or 700 of them.
Wow.
In pistol, rifle, carbine form. So like, if you're going to talk about the Belton, I would much rather you talk about that Belton, because it was actually something that was successful. And we have surviving example that the provenance is good on. So that's one of the ones that like, I always, I'm like, oh, it's such a pet peeve of mine. But then the other one, the Puckle gun, I don't love. But there is another gun that I did mention in that talk, which was the Chambers repeating gun. And that's a better example. So it's also a superposed gun, but it's developed in the U.S., which is important, and it's developed around the time of the founding era. So it's, you know, founding era 1791. I think this is early 1790s, and the guy who designed it also created this new kind of ammo. So I mentioned that like with a lot of the superposed guns, you have to like do something in order to make each round fire. He actually created ammo that had like essentially a hole in it. So when you press the trigger, it fired, boom, 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 boom. Like, you couldn't stop it,
yeah.
You know. But it was basically multiple rounds with one trigger pull. Well, he developed this gun. He showed it to Thomas Jefferson, which is also important in the court systems because when the founding fathers aware of it, because if the founding fathers weren't aware of it,
yes.
Then why would they regulate it, right? So he's like, oh, I don't know. This may or may not be something that, you know, we'd want. Why don't you go try to take a patent out for it? Which, you know, meant that, you know, he saw a potential value in it in the civilian market.
Yeah.
He tests it in front of Congress instead of, in front of several representatives. And they do end up adopting some of them for the War of 1812. Mm-hmm. But there's one chamber specifically, he affixes it with multiple barrels. And so you've got multiple rounds in the barrel. Now you have multiple barrels. And with one trigger pull, you could fire 224 rounds.
Wow.
Yeah. And we're talking 1790s.
That was cutting edge technology. I mean, that was the top of the line then.
Yeah, it's and they do end up adopting some of them for the War of 1812. So there is, you know, value in implementation of those firearms. So that's why I always joke, because to me, like the examples, and we could talk all night on, you know, the different types of magazine fed repeaters and other guns that were being made that were kind of quote unquote more modern, at least how we view modern technology. But there's so many examples that it's always interesting to me why some of the weirdest ones become the ones that everybody talks about. It's kind of fascinating. It should be its own case study.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm definitely, personally, I'm going to look into, do a deep dive into each of these so that as I'm having the conversations with people about, you know, what existed, it does sound like both of those are better examples than the Pulco gun, specifically that Belt and Jover with the, like, detachable magazine. That's applicable today.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all the words that pop up in the court system for, you know, magazine cases, quote unquote assault weapons cases. I mean, it is really interesting. My first real Second Amendment case I worked on as an expert was Miller. And so one of the first things I did for those court cases was like go through all of the features that California includes in their definition of an assault weapon. And find the earliest example I could possibly find. And that was really, really interesting. That was if nothing else, a fun academic exercise. Yeah. You know, when did pistol grips start? And when did folding stocks start?
Right,
And threaded barrels and all of that. And so I kind of got the first thing I did in the Second Amendment expert witness world was like one of the bigger cases been in the court system. And I kind of was able to cover a lot of ground in just that one case.
That's pretty impressive. What sparked your interest in firearms initially? Did you grow up in a home that was very pro-firearm?
Oh, no. We weren't pro or anti-firearm. It just wasn't a part of my culture growing up, I guess. It wasn't a part of my family life. I'm from Pittsburgh, so I'm from Western PA. So a lot of people assume that I must have grown up around firearms because it's got a big hunting culture there.
Mm-hmm, but yeah.
Nope. I didn't even know that there was a shooting range in my high school. Like I probably never thought about firearms until I started studying them. I always say, like, if I know high school Ashley and if she had an opinion, she probably didn't like them.
Yeah.
You know, but I have no concept of if I ever had really an opinion about them because they just weren't anything that I was exposed to.
Yeah. What was your awakening?
I got into firearms from a medical standpoint, which is kind of interesting. I always say I did an interview with Ted Koppel years ago, and off camera, we talked about this in a very nuanced way. And then on camera, he interrupted me because I said that I wanted to be a doctor my whole life. And so he interrupted me and he said, so you went from wanting to save lives to things that take them. And then I proceeded to sweat profusely for like the next 2 hours. Wow. In an interview. But and he ended up apologizing. That's its own story, but it was a really good dude. But I wanted to be a doctor because I've had 15 orthopedic surgeries. One of them, I was in a wheelchair for a little bit because they had to like realign my leg and all kinds of
crazy
stuff. Oh,
yeah, I came across that in one of your interviews. Okay, but I didn't know what the backstory was.
So I just spent a lot of time around doctors and in and out of the hospital. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I thought I wanted to do. And I was interested in the history of medicine because you want to talk about some wild history, the history history of medicine is crazy. And so I was always like, we were always going to historic sites. I grew up 3 hours from Gettysburg, so we would go to Gettysburg a lot. And I was interested in the history of battlefield medicine. And so I, you know, would go on these tours and they would talk about how the advances in development of weapons and ammunition technology would change how medical technology had to function on the battlefield.
Did that start like sorry to interrupt you, Ashley, but I'm fascinated because of the teaching part. Like, did that start in like high school for you? Was there a teacher or an experience that you had in one of your classes that sparked the history part for you?
In history? No. I didn't even take history my senior year. I took two AP physics. I think I took AP Calc. Maybe I was just in honors Calc. I don't know.
So what did high school actually think that she was going to do? I'm going to try to share as much of this with my class. Oh, okay.
I was going to be an orthopedic surgeon. Yeah. I was going to be an orthopedic surgeon. Yeah, I didn't. I think it is funny because I didn't even take, I took AP psychology instead of history my senior year.
Yep.
So I think it's kind of funny.
It is.
Because like, I was just like, I was so not into history that I didn't even, take the class. But I was like, I mean, I found history interesting. I just never really thought, I guess it never really like clicked that people worked in the historical field. And you know, as a history teacher, that not a lot of people do successfully.
True.
So I started studying the guns themselves from like the medical perspective. So like early, very high level ballistics. And I don't know, I switched my major to history my freshman year at University of Delaware, and my mom was not happy. She's a physics teacher.
Oh.
And she told me that I better have a job when
better have some ideas.
Yeah.
You're gonna support yourself.
Which I was a little concerned about that too. Yeah. But yeah, I got I got an internship in Pittsburgh at a military museum right after I started studying guns. And there were basically like 200 guns in a collection that I had to catalog. So like person who has never held a gun before in their life, I'm having to catalog what it is, what have been modified, like all that stuff. And I just kind of got hooked on it. I got really interested in the social history component of it. Obviously, if I'm interested in the history of medicine, I am interested in some of the gory, darker details.
The terminal ballistics.
History. Yeah, of weapons history. Actually, when I was when I had my show on Discovery Channel, I was like, they were all about crossovers, like having their people on different shows, and I was like, can I be on Ghost Adventures? And they were like, no. They were like, absolutely not, because they did not want to associate the firearms on our show with ghosts.
Ooh, I have a related question later on. I have to get back to it. So sorry, please go ahead.
No. So I had that kind of fascination with that kind of more social history, how weapons have impacted people, society, industry throughout history for better or worse.
Yeah.
Or indifferent, you know, not every experience with a firearm has to be a positive or a negative one. They just are, you know, they've just been around, which I feel like they've been around more like that than they've been in other ways. And people just, you know, we glorify or demonize them. And you kind of forget about the fact that they're just around and they're normal.
That's an interesting perspective that I don't think very many people actually realize. I think you pointed out when somebody thinks of a firearm, if they're in favor of them, they look at it very favorable as to what they could be used for to an advantage. And if somebody dislikes them, then they automatically associate the negatives that firearms can bring. But you're right. I mean, how many firearms on a daily basis are just there in existence?
Exactly. You know, a friend of mine, he's a professor at Wake Forest. I don't know if you've ever encountered him. He does Gun Culture 2.0.
No.
And yeah, he's really interesting. He's a liberal sociology professor, and he wrote a book. It's amazing, on gun culture. He's written a book on concealed carry, and he's got a great article about, you know, how a liberal professor ended up becoming a gun owner. But his whole thing is, you know, guns are normal and normal people own guns.
Wow.
Is kind of what part of his mission is, you know, in dealing with, you know, the walk between academia and the gun world. But it's true. I mean, one of the things when I was running the Cody Firearms Museum, you know, that I tried to kind of explain, and I do it now in my consulting business, is like, visitors, because of firearms and the debate in America, people bring baggage, you know, with every artifact, people are going to bring baggage you know, to the museum that they may have that may affect their interpretation of an object.
Yes.
And when I dealt with guns, you know, I was always kind of talking about how, you know, to a lot of people, they're going to come in, they're going to see like a tricked out 22 that a biathlete, you know, is using, but they're, you know, that has absolutely nothing to do with violence, you know, any of those things, but like they are going to project that, you know, onto the object, even though the object may not have anything to do with that.
Right.
And so trying to find a way in the museum world where we can interpret objects that strip that initial barrier to understanding, because most of the guns in the Cody Firearms Museum, for example, were sporting arms, you know, and they didn't have this huge connection to any grander other than the military guns. You know, they weren't things used in a lot of crimes or anything like that. So I mean, like so many of them are, you know, germane, but it's how I've kind of made it a mission to try to figure out how to interpret it for people that are bringing so much and projecting so much onto the object that the object doesn't actually retain or hold.
Because we all have our predispositions of what things are.
I mean, it's interesting. It's a difficult topic. I've had a lot of success and I'm still learning ways to do it because it is really hard. It's increasingly more difficult, I feel like, right now to work with guns. It's kind of how I ended up becoming, you know, pretty successful with the museum world, because like there are guns in almost every museum in America, but there are very few people that study guns. And so, you know, that's where I, and the people that study guns and like, you know, historic guns, they tend to just be the collector by the collector for the collector. And then the museum people tend to be the museum people, you know, the trained museum people that don't know anything about guns, maybe even don't like guns, or at least are afraid of them and don't know what to do with them in their collections. And so it was a interesting niche to find, because it's something that's lacking in the US, not as much in Europe, ironically.
That's a interesting conundrum to have to maybe make that distinction for somebody that's running a museum that might not like guns, but to make them at least understand the importance and relevance of that gun in history. And that's interesting, because that's something I've actually never considered myself.
Yeah. And it's, I would say most, I would say it's probably a solid majority of the museum field is not necessarily either. I would say a solid majority is doesn't know anything about guns, and probably a good chunk aren't the biggest fans. But you know, it's interesting because like where you get countries that don't have the gun culture, quote unquote, that America has, you find that it's a lot easier to engage with the material in museums and in academic centers. You can get degrees in it overseas, but you can't here. I'm trying to fix that right now, but it is like, it's kind of ironic, right?
Do you feel like a pioneer as far as that's concerned?
No, no. I don't think so.
No,
no, I'm not that brave, but I'm just trying to navigate a minefield, to be honest. You know, it's a tightrope walk that I deal with. You know, we started, I co-founded a research center at the University of Wyoming in the College of Law, and that is more of a Second Amendment center, but it's not just a law center. It's also because I'm not a lawyer, I'm a historian. So like a lot of it's history. We work with public health. We work with sociologists. We work with business, the business school. We work with the education departments, you know, all of that. But it has been really interesting because you deal with the fact that like, this idea of trying to have balanced information, like everyone's always skeptical of you. So like for us, when Wall Street Journal did a profile on us, when we first opened, you know, it was actually a decent profile. It was probably the best one we were going to get. But they, you know, did want to focus in on the fact that we had taken money from the gun industry, which, you know, well, optically, I guess if you don't like guns, that makes you look like, you know, the tobacco industry, you know, creating a research center that says the tobacco doesn't, you know, isn't bad for you. But, you know, under the surface, you know, the reality is, and I'm very, very passionate about this, but because if you have any level of ethics in nonprofits, donors don't dictate content. And not one person that's ever given me money has had stipulations on it. If they do, I don't accept it, unless it's like, I want to fund a job, like a position, right? That's different. But like, you know, so it sounds really scary, right? And nefarious, the way you phrase it like that. But the reality is, and also the reality is that it's a small percentage of the money we get every year at the research center. But that then automatically, you know, discredits us to a solid portion of, you know, the population. Oh, they took gun money. Clearly, they're not nonpartisan, except for the fact that my research center has everybody from pro-gun rights scholars that are fellows to we have a pacifist. You know, we try to balance our information as much as possible. But it's a difficult thing in the U.S. because the second you step a toe where you could be on one side or the other, then like immediately there's a population or group of people that are there to bash you down.
Absolutely.
And then they invalidate all the research that you do, despite the fact that research might be good. It might be irrelevant how you actually feel personally versus, you know, how you're handling something professionally. So I'm not a pioneer, a tightrope walker.
Interesting.
I would imagine then that you have to get frustrated on a regular basis when you see the Second Amendment and its, or the issues regarding the Second Amendment get tossed around like a political football. I'd imagine that has to get under your skin a little bit.
It's very frustrating. There's lots of this field that's very, very frustrating. It's very hard seeing the dehumanization of the other that goes on in our field pretty bad. I do expert witness testimony. I do a range of expert witness testimonies work. I work on product liability, trade dress. I've done criminal cases in Canada, ironically. And I've done Second Amendment cases. And I mentioned that I worked on Miller. I worked on Miller before Bruin. And for people who might not be aware, so in 2022, the Supreme Court ruled on the Bruin decision, which basically put history as one of the most important determinants of the constitutionality of a modern gun law. And it's a very complicated thing. But what happened there, you know, if you're pro-gun, it was this great thing because, as we've been talking about, the technologies, you know, that we associate as modern have been around for a really long time.
Right.
And there have been a lot of successes in the courts on the gun side. What people don't realize happened was that it activated the other side to get their stuff together. Because when I was working on Miller before Bruin, I had an evidentiary hearing and the state showed up intentionally unprepared. And there was a reason for that, but, you know, their witnesses were unprepared, you know, and it was really like, I honestly, it was the first time I was like, damn, I'm kind of offended on behalf of the taxpayers of California that they would waste like all this money, right?
Yes.
All these witnesses, all this time to show up unprepared just so that they could kick a football down the road. I almost just exposed myself for my lack of sports knowledge there. Like kick a football somewhere.
Down the field.
So it was this really fascinating thing. And then I did my deposition afterwards. And when I was done, the state was like incredibly grateful. They were like, wow, this was really interesting. Thank you so much. Thank you for not getting mad at me, you know, or getting emotional about it. And I work with everybody. Like I've built a career off of working with everybody. Like I don't go into any scenario with judgment, like, because I found that more people ask questions because they don't know, but a lot of people are on the defensive, and understandably so. So they take it the wrong way when somebody asks something. So I try to go in completely like, you know, this isn't, you know, I'm not personally, you know, I'm not the dog in the fight. You're paying me to have, you know, for my expertise.
That's really commendable.
I had this really great, it was so great. And then Bruin passed. And I worked on a case in Rhode Island. And it was the first time in my entire career that I have been treated the way that I was treated. You know, and as a millennial who suffers from extraordinary imposter syndrome, because that's just beaten into us from a young age, you know, I had finally been like, you know what? I've had a great career. I'm a good expert. This judge did not think so. and basically it was 7 PhDs against me. So that's that whole activating the system, right? And I have a master's degree, so
yeah.
That judge said horrible things about me, but basically came down to, I don't have a PhD, so I don't know what I'm talking about, except for the fact that the expert, one of the experts I was going up against, had no idea that a Sharps rifle was a single shot, and he kept calling it a 7-shot repeater. So that person knew more than me.
Okay.
But what happened was basically, though, that like you have the whole academic community at your disposal when it comes to the other side, typically.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, they were like, you know, funded completely, and then they would just send people after me, and it would just be me. When I worked on Oregon, the Measure 114 case, I mean, they had multiple attorneys assigned to just me, digging into everything I've ever said. But the reality was, is that, you know, and then what kept getting people so mad is because I'm not paid to have an opinion like that. And that's, I mean, my opinion's based off of like, you know, did this technology exist? Yes.
Right.
Do
they're substantive facts.
And then they tried to, you know, they tried to say like, well, then what do you agree with Oregon Measure 114? And I would continue to say, that's not why I was hired. Like, I don't study Measure 114. And they'd be like, well, surely you know about it. And I would be like, no, I'm like, I was hired to write this history. I'm not stepping out of my lane, right? And that made that side furious. And so in order to get me out as a witness, they had to make me into a monster. And it was really, really hard. I don't do a lot of that testimony anymore. I'd rather do, you know, I started to realize that if I kept doing it, my role in public education was going to suffer because it was going to instantly make half of the population not want to listen to me.
Sure.
And so, but like that dehumanization side of things, like I'm probably the least controversial person you could ever get in this field. I mean, maybe I'm controversial for other reasons, but not for guns. You know, I have been very, very good about, you know, welcoming people and talking to people. And when you can turn me into a monster, or you try to turn me into a monster, I mean, I was getting threatening phone calls. You know, if you were able to do that to me, I mean, yeah. So it, like, there's so much level of that frustration. And trust me, I've been called a Bolshevik by broken people too, which is completely out of left field. I did not mean that pun. But like within a 24-hour period, like a month or two ago, I was called a woke anti-gun academic that ruined the Cody Firearms Museum. And then later that day, a shill for the gun industry by a university that didn't want to partner with us on a conference. So I was like, wow. Man, I guess that means I'm doing something right. I don't know. But that is probably one of the more frustrating things, that, you know, we dehumanize one another.
Right.
But then the people who are trying to, you know, find some ground where they can have a dialogue, you're even making them out to be monsters. And, you know, it makes it very difficult to have a place to land. And so that's probably the most frustrating part of what I do is, you know, it's gotten so combative that now even the people like trying to have the dialogue have to be the enemy too.
Yeah. Seems like a byproduct of our times.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. It's not fun. But I love what I do. But I also I'm not only doing, you know, Second Amendment work. I mean, I've got my research center at the university, but that's pretty much it when it comes to like the Second Amendment work that I do. Most of my work is firearms research, working with museums. I'm building a machine gun museum in Canada, which is a trip.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. It's actually really cool. The collection is awesome. Wow. But yeah, so like it's not the only thing I do, which thank goodness. Because
and you
I don't
go
know
beyond firearms too, right?
What's that?
You go beyond firearms too, right? If I remember right.
Yeah, yeah. So the one thing that I always tell people is that, you know, today firearms to a lot of people seem like this kind of subculture, this thing that's off to the side, or even counterculture to a lot of people. But like for hundreds of years, firearms have been integral to understanding pretty much everything. And so, you know, Henry Ford visited Winchester, Henry Ford owned Winchester's and visited Winchester in 1909 before he built his Highland Park factory in 1910 and was inspired by what Winchester did. And people also talk about it, their inspiration from Colt, but we don't know if he ever went to Colt, but he did go to Winchester. This interconnectivity of industries and people and society. So as a result, I blend into other into other areas. Sorry, that was real bad. Into other areas. I'm going to get canceled.
You're on fire today.
I kind of, you know, I go into these different areas. So I work with a lot of like crime museums, law enforcement museums, military museums. But me personally, I'm super into the macabre. So I also study like all kinds of like the evolution of like the ghost tourism industry and dark tourism, and why people are drawn to sites of mourning, why we're drawn to stuff like that. You know, why do we visit battlefields? Why do people visit Auschwitz? Like what is it about tragedy that makes us, you know, look, you know, and travel to go to. So yeah, I do expand. I do know a little bit about edged weapons, but I don't tend to talk about it very often because I know a little bit. And you know, I've done some stuff with longbows and crossbows, but a lot of it ends up being like firearms adjacent. So scholarship like that I come to because this museum has a huge gun collection. So they brought me on because of the gun collection. And now all of a sudden I'm writing an exhibition on the gangster squad, which is something I'm doing right now. So I've kind of built off from there, but there's so many ways that firearms touch so many different things that like it's so easy. I did an interview for PBS a few years ago. Gosh, I think it's like 5 years ago now. And we talked about that. Like I can pretty much take, you can take pretty much, I'm going to say this and then you're going to give me an example. I'm not going to be able to do it, but you can take like a lot of topics and that seem like they have absolutely nothing to do with guns. And I can find a way that
6 degrees of firearms,
right? 6 degrees of firearm separation. Yeah. You know, like in the front of the Cody Firearms Museum, like leading into the museum, cause there's this big hallway that I wasn't allowed to use. Which I'm not bitter about it or anything, but I have these three cases. And the first case is an Abercrombie and Fitch case. Because everyone knows Abercrombie and Fitch,
right,
but a lot of people don't realize that Abercrombie and Fitch was this like bomb, like sportsman store in New York that was like 9 floors tall and they sold guns and like, they had like a swimming pool. It was crazy. It was so cool.
I didn't know either.
Yeah. That's where it started. It started as a sporting goods store. And then it grew to be this like giant, like building in New York City. And oddly enough, like the largest distributor of Mahjong in the country, but that was its own weird side tangent. that I can't remember if it was Fitch or Abercrombie because one of them left
came
early
across
on.
It and had it in their store.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they thought it was really cool. And then they just were like, all right, we're going all in. But like, so that Abercrombie and Fitch connection. And then the next case is a M1 carbine stock made by Louisville Slugger to talk about how companies that weren't affiliated with guns made guns and gun parts during the war.
During the war, yeah.
And then the last one, And then the last one was a Winchester Model 1887 serial number one that belonged to Henry Ford, was given to him by Harvey Firestone. And then a little cute, fun side story is that Firestone, Ford, Edison, and John Burroughs, who was a naturalist, used to travel around the country in a Ford. They called themselves the Vagabonds, and they would go like hunting and camping and like all kinds of fun stuff. And so I had that on display because, you know, here's a bunch of names that we recognize, you know, that we don't necessarily associate with guns. And then that was the connection to the story I just told about, you know, Ford visiting Winchester, and that we wouldn't have the assembly line that we associate so much with Ford if it wasn't for Colt's inline manufacturing and Winchester's manufacturing capabilities. I mean, they were taken directly. Ford took ideas directly from them and made them better. So we wouldn't have the assembly line that you learn about in school without Winchester and Colt.
Yep. I'm glad you came back to that. So Henry Ford, when he visited the factories, that's where he got his ideas to form an assembly line that he got a lot of credit for establishing or creating the idea of an assembly line, but he actually got it from maybe Winchester and Colt.
So, I mean, I'm not going to say that he didn't have like this brilliant idea without visiting the factories, but he did his due diligence. And we know he visited Winchester. I don't know if we know for sure if he visited Colt, but Colt, the company, I'm going to say the company, Colt as a company, you know, really pioneered inline manufacturing processes and set up the American system of manufacturing. It was not Sam Colt. It was Alicia Root, who ran Colt after he died, was a superintendent for a while too. He made the machines, not, you know, not Colt. Colt's a client of mine. I'm doing a lot of history for them and So if you want to get deep into cold history, I got you. Yeah. And so they had like very well-known manufacturing, you know, capacity. I mean, that's something that's very, very well-known to gun people, probably not to non-gun people, but would have been known to Henry Ford back then without the like levels of stigma that gun companies are kind of packed into nowadays. But we do know, because there's letters in the Winchester records, which are at the Cody Firearms Museum, that Henry Ford did visit Winchester, and he wrote about it and how, you know, the you know, manufacturing processes that Winchester, you know, inspired ideas that he used to create his assembly line. I don't know enough about industrial history to know exactly what he took from like Winchester and what he made himself. I don't know that, but you know, that was his inspiration. You know, and we lose that piece of the story because guns, you know, right. And I think, you know, to come back to what we talked about at the beginning, I think some of that too is all about, you know, digestible bits, right? That ends up becoming a digestible bit. Henry Ford invented the assembly line. Well, if you're trying to teach a student something, you know, and you don't want to go totally off a tangent, you'd be like, well, actually, he also visited Winchester and Colt did this thing. It becomes really hard for people to comprehend. Yep. So you knock pieces of it out. And, you know, I think today we knock a lot of the gun pieces out.
Sure, absolutely. Just to make sure that guns aren't being mentioned in conjunction with learning.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's tough. But I try to tell people that don't know anything about guns or have hesitancy about guns at least one fact that they may not know that has a connection to firearms that maybe they have a connection to. Because people are usually pretty open to learning. At least they used to be. I don't know. I hide away from people nowadays. But usually people have been pretty open to learning stuff like that. You know, that's not a statement on culture or a statement on, you know, violence in America, like in all this conversations today. Like, that's just like a fact that is interesting to somebody that doesn't, you know, hurt or harm them.
Yeah,
you
there's
know,
no that side kind to of pick. Doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no side to pick. It's, you know, we know he went to Winchester. He wrote about it, you know. And I want to say, like, in the letter to, like, from one of the Winchester executives, they thought his idea for his assembly line was crazy. Like, that wasn't going to work. I think there was something in there that, like, he wants to do this with it? No, that's not going to work. I feel like there was something in the archives like that.
So when you were at Cody Firearm Museum, that was about how long ago did you depart from there?
So I was at Cody in one way, shape, or form from like 2011 to 2021. So I was there for 10 years.
Gotcha.
And I had a lot of different positions, but I was the curator in charge of the whole firearms museum. I was the project director. So I was in charge of a full-scale renovation of the museum. So we gutted the museum completely and rebuilt it. And that reopened in 2019. And I had always planned on leaving Cody. Like, I had never, Wyoming wasn't my, you know, wasn't for me long term. Like, I didn't want to live there forever. And meanwhile, I started a research center in Wyoming, but I don't live in Wyoming anymore. So I'd always kind of been like, okay, I'm going to do this project and then I'm going to move on. And so it was no surprise to anybody. I made it very, you know, sure. I didn't want to, you know, shock anyone. So the museum reopened in 2019. I stayed on as curator for another year so that I could close out the budget, train my assistant, who's now the curator there, make sure that he was good to go. You know, because after you do a renovation, like, things break that you didn't anticipate breaking and you have problems that you didn't anticipate. Sure. So I just wanted to kind of make sure. I didn't want to, like, open the museum and then be like, and now I'm out, you know. So I stayed on for till 2020 as the curator. And then I transitioned into a consulting role for another year to 2021, just so that if they needed anything from me, they had any questions. Danny's the curator now. If he needed any like actual physical help, I could provide that. I mean, he and I are like super good friends, so he can ask me anything. But this was a little bit more of at least a formal role. Like, if he couldn't find something in a file or whatever, like, I stayed on to make sure that he was all good to go, and then I stepped back. But yeah, it was a great experience, but it was kind of tough because, you know, most people work their whole careers and never get to build a museum. And I did that pretty much before my 30th birthday. I turned 30 like 2 weeks before we opened the museum. And so I definitely have had for years that kind of like, oh crap. Did I peak? Like, what do I do now? like nothing will ever be as cool as that.
But,
and now I'm building two museums right now.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that. Cause you're doing some consulting in conjunction with that, correct?
Yeah. So I've got the research center at the University of Wyoming. I am working with some colleagues on a new research center in the UK called the Center for the Study of Arms History, which is going to be more material culture focused. Which is the study of objects, the study of technology. And then I've been working with the LA Police Museum for probably about 4 years now, helping them with everything from like creating collection plans, all that boring paperwork up through exhibit design and helping them to identify donors. I've worked with the Mott Museum over the years on a bunch of different projects. I work for so many people right now, and I'm like blanking on all of them. So I'm working on that museum up in Canada, which I can't say a ton about right now. Although we're hoping it'll be built by the end of 2027. I just got my work permit, so if I wanted to move to Canada for 2 years, I could. Wow. I don't, but I could.
Right.
So we're building that. It's going to be focused on two pieces, Canadian firearms history, which is way interesting, way more interesting than I thought it was, and way more involved than I thought it was. Because Canada didn't have an NFA, like they had better gun laws than us, like until the 70s.
No kidding.
Idea. You could have whatever you wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's some really interesting history there. And then like a reference library collection that is, it's mostly machine guns. It's kind of interesting. In the U.S., museums that are non-government are bound by all gun laws. So Cody can only have guns that people can legally own. A government museum is different. They can have whatever, but right. It's not because they're a museum. It's because they're a government entity. So like the museum wasn't even considered. It wasn't like they did something nice for museums. It's a government facility. Yeah. In Canada, though, if you have a museum license, you can have whatever you want. You can have things that we can't get in America. You can import whatever you want. So it's really kind of ironic that in Canada, the gun laws for museums are way better than they are here. Wow. So I've got like stuff in that collection that like we can't get in America because we can't import it.
That's probably pretty cool to see. But then their citizens can't have nearly the firearms our citizens can.
Exactly. But as a museum nerd, that excites me.
Oh, yeah. I bet it does.
As it should.
Right.
And then I've been doing work. So I'm working on a few small museum projects for some gun companies. Like I said, I'm also doing some history work for Colt. I'm all over the place. I do a lot of different things.
You are.
Yeah, you're saying you stay busy. You're not watching not watching a lot of television over there.
I do live in New Hampshire and everything closes at 8:00. So I've been watching more I used to live in Phoenix and my husband and I are currently in New Hampshire. And it's not my favorite, but we're here. And everything closes. So we've actually been watching a lot more TV, but I will tell you, it has nothing to do. My TV never has anything to do with guns, aliens, true crime. I guess guns and true crime, but like that's about as far as it goes. I don't watch the shows I'm on. I'm on Gun Stories with Joe Montana every week. I don't know if people watch that, but it's been on for a really long time.
Yep. Saw him at SHOT Show.
He's the best. Oh, he's just the sweetest guy. I was just on a show. It's on Fox Nation. We're about to film 4 more episodes. Sean Hannity's Wanted Dead or Alive. It's about gangsters. So we did like Dillinger and Babyface Nelson and Bonnie and Clyde and Ma Barker. And we just got picked up for 4 more episodes. So we're doing that. So I still do a lot of TV stuff, but I don't watch myself unless I'm worried I said something stupid, and then I will watch myself.
Do you like firearms personally from a self-defense or sport aspect?
So, I mean, do I like firearms personally? Yes. So this is an interesting conversation that I've been having. My husband works for Sig Sauer, and he used to be a pro shooter. And I carry sometimes. I really have gotten out of the habit. I probably shouldn't admit that on a podcast. Someone's going to come and attack me now. So ignore that. Ignore that. So I have a lot of medical problems, which I think we already covered. Yeah, so the experience of shooting for me is not a lot of fun. And I know that there's lots of people with different disabilities that shoot. So I'm not saying that it's like, oh, because I have these medical problems, I can't shoot. It is really painful for me. And it's not, and it's like with a 22 as well. Like, it's super weird. Gotcha. My husband and I are like going to start testing some things out to see why this keeps happening to me. But it's not even when I'm shooting, it's the next day. And it's like this like overall systemic muscle pain and joint pain that I have. Mm. It's really weird. And I can't explain it. And it's very frustrating because it does keep me from, you know, spending a lot of time on the range. Sure. I shoot for work a lot. So like I will shoot the heck out of a hand cannon and a matchlock and a flintlock. That's fun. That's a ton of fun for me, although that hurts really fast. But
I bet it
that
does.
Is a ton of fun for me. But
pay for it later.
I really don't know. I don't know what it is about shooting that is so, that causes me such pain, but it does. So I don't really do it a ton for fun because I always am, which is like so weird because I still have a lot of medical problems. Like I've got torn cartilage in both my wrists. I have a pinched nerve in my elbow. You know, I've got weaknesses from all my surgeries. So, I mean, there's obvious things that like, you know, okay, my wrists are problematic. That's probably why my wrists hurt after I shoot. And all of that. But like, I lift weights. Like, it's not like I, you know, I weightlift 6 days a week and I can do that. So I don't know what it is. If anyone who listens to this podcast is a doctor that can explain to me why I can lift massive amounts of weights in the gym, but I shoot a 22 and I'm like curled up in a ball the next day, I would love to know. Now that I said that, someone's going to be like, someone's going to call me anti-gun or something. They're going to call me like that reporter that got really.
There's like a shockwave that's involved with the.
That's what I think, but I feel like if I say that to anybody, like they're just gonna look at me like I'm crazy. So I kind of just
ridiculous.
Like
ridiculous. They shouldn't say that if they're thinking it.
I never used to bring it up. But then I've been at a lot of things recently where people are like, oh, you want to shoot this? You want to shoot this? You want to shoot this? And I'm like, no.
No, not really.
Yeah. And I'll shoot like a little bit, you know, but you know, I normally didn't bring it up because I always thought if people because people always assume I'd be like a pro shooter or something. And I'm very much living my life, my special life of those who can't do teach. And, you know, I'm not a great shot. I'm highly average, not bad, but I'm not great. Right. And I don't really have I don't have the sustainability to kind of keep working on it. So I like them in my personal life. I like collecting them. I don't mind shooting them, but you know, I just got to figure out what this issue is because it makes it not enjoyable. So it's not really something that I'll go and hang out at the range and smoke a cigar. Like that's where you'll find me. It's like standing on the range with a cigar.
That's not a bad day either.
Posing.
Yeah.
So
maybe it's the cigar. I don't know. Maybe it's the tobacco.
So in your collection, is there an era that you like to focus on? Or is it all over the place?
So I used to say I collect what I can afford, which is nothing that exciting. My husband has quite a substantial collection. I've got like little odd things here or there that I think are cool. Like I've got a Sharps Pepperbox pistol. Sharps did make a repeater. It's not a 7-shot repeater like that one professor thinks. They did make a 4-shot pistol. It was not great. It had nothing to do with the company that made that when he worked on the Sharps rifle, but he did make a pistol. So I've got like that. I've got a non-Derringer because I think I love that.
Just fun.
No, those are cool, right?
Yeah, the non-Derringers are great. And it's just like some random old stuff, but no real focus. But what I do collect with a massive focus is gun advertisements from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, where women are very scantily dressed.
No kidding. Yeah. I wouldn't have guessed, but that's okay.
No,
you do. You.
I'm in this gun collector. I'm in a bunch of gun collecting groups, but you know, one of them, we have to stand up and say what we collect every meeting. And because I'm there because I'm in the field, right? I'm there because I'm a historian. I'm there because I work with museum collections. But I stood up and said that I collected naked lady gun posters, and I became very popular.
Yeah.
They're funny because like all the collectors are required to display at least once at the meetings, and they're like, "When are you going to do that display?" But I do. I collect these advertisements, specifically Winchester. / Olin, because Olin owned Winchester back then, at that point in its history. And they're all international ads. Winchester hired Playboy in the 1980s to do a series of ads. But the ones over in Europe are like...
Oh, you'll get more racy stuff from Europe.
Oh, yeah. In Europe, like I have one, and it's kind of funny because they're in my office. And so I have to blur my background when I do a lot of podcasts because there's like a butt like behind my head. But there's like That's this funny. One series. So, there's like this one where like this lady's being branded by the Winchester logo. I have one where this woman is naked with like a little crop shotgun vest. And she's straddling a shotgun, and it says "riding shotgun" in Italian. It's a Winchester ad. This is a Winchester.
That's a pretty
ad.
Good one, actually. That's
right. It's really words. Good.
Yeah.
When I was in grad school, I was very much discouraged from studying guns, even though they accepted me knowing I worked at the Smithsonian's firearms collection. But once I got there, they were very much like, "Well, you shouldn't study guns." So I had to kind of make workarounds. And one of them was that like we were doing this research and writing course, and I wanted to write about gendered advertising in like the late 19th, early 20th century. And that was not happening. And so I expanded to these naked ladies in the 60s, 70s and 80s. And I didn't end up writing about them. Instead, I started writing about armed leftist and feminist activism in the 60s and 70s, which is really weird, crazy history. Because I thought it was funny that you have these like hardcore radicals, the second wave of feminists that armed themselves were very much like not just topple the patriarchy, but like destroy the government.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the radical activists, you could take a shooting class on campus at Berkeley in the 70s. Mm-hmm. I mean, just like, so I just found it kind of
Chicago
funny.
As well. Yeah, you could go to UIC, University of Illinois, Chicago. They had a range, if I'm not mistaken. Hope I'm not wrong on that. So, I don't think I am.
Yeah, you're fine. No one's going to fact check you. But I found it really funny. I don't know. In the academic term, it was a great juxtaposition of these like armed, hardcore feminists that are carrying guns and like learning to shoot and learning about gun laws and all this stuff. And then these naked women.
That's oddly specific.
In these gun advertisements. what a weird time to be alive.
Yeah. That's an interesting combination there.
So I thought it was, I don't know, made me laugh. So that's what I studied my second year of grad school. And that's how I ended up with all these ads, because I started digging into it. And so now I've got people that when I go to gun shows, they're like, hey, I got another one. I got one for you.
That's
and I'm walking
funny.
Through
they're
a gun
hooking
show.
You up.
Like,
do they pull it out of their sock? Like, you know, hey, I snuck this in for you.
And then I'm always walking through a gun show with this like crazy looking like framed picture.
Oh, that's great. Dudes,
like, yeah. You're gonna have to bring the big bags to put them in so nobody knows what you're carrying around.
Well, we'll keep an eye out for you, okay, Ashley?
I think I'm well known enough at a lot of these shows that people have come to expect this level of behavior from me.
Well, I would have to think after all the education and the Cody Firearm Museum, that your tenure there, and it sounds like great success with that. Your consulting, everything you're doing now. Is it safe to say your mom's not upset that you didn't go to medical school anymore?
She is very happy.
Good.
She's very happy.
I would think she would be.
I told her, you know, the irony is I have a friend, same grade as me. She's a doctor, and I am definitely doing better financially than she is. You know, we started at the same time, for the exact same age. I don't have all the debt.
All the debt.
Ironically, my school was paid for. Like Delaware paid their Dutchess paid the tuition, but paid like a nominal salary to their grad students. Oh, that's so my school was paid for.
Good for you.
So I am definitely in a better position financially than if I had gone through now. Doctored eventually, right? Will probably pass me by, but right now I don't have any debt, so
and you're okay with that? And you're happy doing what you do.
I love it. You know, obviously there's the stuff that we talked about, the bad stuff with the gun debate and the nastiness of the people. But what I do is so much fun. Like, it's so cool, and I get to like talk to different people all the time and educate people, and it's a ton of fun. I love it.
That's great. Good for you.
So you said that you're interested in into sort of like the social connection, the spirituality, and it just so happens like I jotted a question down before we talked, and I was wondering if there's like any historical object that you've picked up that really kind of like gave you the chills, like where you're just like,
yes. Yeah. I was worried for you for a second that you were going to bring up Sarah Winchester. I was worried for you because you would never. and it wasn't a gun. So this is something that I find very interesting. I haven't yet, knock on wood. I'm sure it will happen, but I've been around a lot of guns used in a lot of crimes, and they have not freaked me out as much as a weapon that's more like personal, right? Like something that you got to get close to the person.
Sure.
And the one that really, really freaked me out was the rope that was used to strangle Sharon Tate.
That one
made me uncomfortable. That one is the LA Police Museum. Oh, sometimes houses like, yeah, like, I don't know why, like maybe because I just work around guns so much. So they're not this mystical thing to me. Yeah. So like, you know, looking at like the Derringer that was used to assassinate Lincoln didn't freak me out as bad as like this rope, because it's just so like in your face, right? Like to use that.
And it touched her.
And like her clothes were underneath in an evidence bag. And you can see it was a clear evidence bag. But yeah, that freaked me out. Wow. And I will say, I do a lot of like ghost tourism. I write programming for museums and things because it makes them a lot of money. I always joke with institutions. So I'll be like, is your building haunted? And they'll be like, no. And I'll be like, can it be? Yeah. You know, like, can we make it haunted? But I'm kind of like, whatever about it all. I find it really interesting. I find the study of ghost tourism interesting. I don't know if I believe in ghosts, but I will say that the LA Police Museum as a building is creepy. Like, there are days that you go, I'm not a very spiritual person. I'm not a very, like, you know, like, I think it's interesting, but like, there are days I go into the LA Police Museum and I am I'm uncomfortable. Like, it just makes you uncomfortable to be in there. And I go there a lot, and I should point out that they house all the, they were housing all of the evidence boxes with the Manson murders.
Yeah, I was going to say Manson, I bet, is there. Yeah.
They had all of the files for Marilyn Monroe's death. Mm. They have everything from the North Hollywood shootout. Two people have taken their lives in the building because it was an old police station. Mm. One officer shot herself down the shooting range, and one pedophile hanged himself because he did not want to get moved to real prison. Mm-hmm. So he hanged himself in the the holding cells. So like, there's like weirdness to the building and the artifacts that are in the building, like that, like those types of artifacts, like freak me out. And the building in and of itself, which is an artifact, that place freaks me out sometimes. Some days I go in and it's totally fine, and then there are other days and I'm like, I don't want to be in here. And it's not because I don't want to do the work, it's just the building in and of itself has a vibe.
That's interesting.
I have to ask you one more thing. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
But I have these wonderful students, and I wanted to actually play a game, and I don't want to, you know, do it tonight. If you wanted to, I was going to ask you certain time periods that we study in our curriculum, and then have you come up with, I call it history's power place, and I wanted you to come up with like a weapon for that time period that you think had a big impact. And so, like, describe the weapon and then rate it on a scale of 1 to 10 about how impactful it was. And okay. Would you like to do that at some point with, like, for my students somehow? Like, whether it's like a separate podcast
for sure.
or
do you want to
maybe
give me,
like a call in or something? Like,
I'd love to call in, but now I kind of am like, give me a time period.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you're so cool. Well, I was just going through like our curriculum. And so my sixth graders start off with like early man. But I didn't know if you ever like had any experience with anything like that old.
How old?
So like early man. So this would have been like, you know, caveman.
Oh, caveman. No, because I don't do, there's flint and stone tools.
Yes.
It kind of counts, but no, I didn't do much with like, although I did just do an interview about like early old catapult.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Because the next thing would have been like earlier civilizations. So that would be the next era.
So this isn't, I'm bad at this game, but this isn't a, this is a kind of an interesting thing. It's gun related, but it's not a gun specific, but the control of gun ownership by the Ottoman Empire is really interesting.
Okay.
There are guns from that time frame that are Ottoman guns, but clearly made by like countries that they had conquered.
Yes.
For the Ottomans. That. Yeah. So that's more of a gun culture statement. So I really failed at that game. But that when you're talking early civilization and weaponry, I am really struck by the Ottoman Empire and the way that they, you know, controlled guns around their people.
Interesting. Cool.
Yeah. That didn't answer your question.
No, it's okay. And then I was like going to feel you out with the game because I didn't know how far, you know, your experience with all that stuff, you know, was going. And then I sort of like jumped to Age of Exploration after that. Do you want to try one with the Age of Exploration, which would have been around Ottoman time? Was there some type of weaponry that springs to mind that you would go, wow, this was responsible?
Give me the years.
Colonization, the year, so maybe like, you know, like the 1500s, you know, anything after 1492.
I was like 1492, I think. It's like 1490 is the year of one of the 10 shot repeaters that was developed. I think it was like 1490 and like 1530 or something like that.
You're kidding.
That's why when you said 1492, I was like, what? Rifling. Rifling. It's not a gun,
yes,
but okay, rifles, we'll say that.
Yeah.
Rifling, incredibly impactful in the civilian world. Rifling was developed, some people say 1450, others say 1498. Yeah, others say 1498.
Okay.
The oldest surviving rifle or rifled gun, I think, is like 1520, surviving example.
Wow.
And that's because the projectile, the round ball, didn't take to rifling very well unless you had it like fit perfectly, which is why you don't see it adopted on the battlefield until the 19th century, really. People had long rifles, but it wasn't nearly as prominent on the battlefield as people like to think it was. It's very romantic, but rifles. In that early Age of Exploration, that technology was, you know, invaluable to hunting culture, sporting culture all around Europe. Like massive, like nobility. Rifles are tied to so many things because you talk about nobility and people owning guns, but then you can also start talking about hunting with guns on people's property, because in Europe in that time frame, the animals belong to the king.
Yes.
The crown.
Is this related to I happen to be a scout sniper. Is this related to the ghillies?
I don't know.
There was apparently like game wardens in Scotland, but I never learned at sniper school like what time period was specifically.
I don't
but
know.
Apparently we get
up
our heritage from like the ghillie suit that we wear was related to Scottish ghillies, and the ghillies apparently were like, they worked for the lords or royalty or what have you, and they would go out and they were like take them out on hunts.
Yeah.
Or actually protect their protecting their land from poaching.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'll have to look into that. But yeah, I would say rifles, because rifling is not a gun.
Yeah.
But and then impact on a scale of one to 10, 10 being most important or least important?
10 being like it really impacted the time period greatly, and one obviously like was a blip on the radar.
I would say six.
Six.
Because it was very, it was a huge deal for hunting.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge deal for sport shooting, which we know sport shooting dates to at least 1475. And they were popular, like so popular, like wow, hundreds of people coming from all over Europe to compete, you know, in the early 1600s. So it was incredibly popular, but because it wasn't something that the military necessarily was full scale adopting, it keeps it lower on the importance list.
Yes.
Whereas like, this is not a gun, but if I had to pick something that was very important to the 1800s, it would have been the Meunier ball, or the development of the conically shaped projectile, you know?
Yeah.
And then that makes rifling way more significant.
For sure. Yeah. And then like, I didn't go for that because like, that was too, that was like obvious. I knew that if I asked you like the entire period that we would probably go there. So I tried to do ones that maybe you would be able to like,
well, I think you know, if you go, if you go early, you know, I'm not great with early civilizations, but I mean, if you pick any development of like the longbow and the crossbow and distance weaponry, with the establishment of forts, when forts started becoming popular, now I'm really digging into my background because I have not thought about this time frame in a long time.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to do this with you. That's cool.
That would be like that would probably be like a 10, any type of distance weapon. So whether it be a catapult or the early, you know, guns, crossbows, longbows, all of that is very, very important when forts become prominent.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. Thank you.
All right.
You're awesome.
Yes, absolutely. A wealth of knowledge that I really, really appreciate.
No worries. This was fun.